Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We are speaking to you from the Waldorf Astoria in New York City. You are about to hear an address on the crisis in the Middle East by Dr. Abba Hillel Silver, one of the foremost spiritual leaders of our country, sponsored by the Zionist Organization of America. As spokesman of the Zionist movement, Dr. Silver led the effort in the United Nations, which resulted in the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948. This occasion is a dinner under the auspices of the Zionist Organization of America, which fosters the development of Israel and seeks to strengthen the ties of friendship between the people of the United States and Israel. Dr. Silver is about to be introduced by Rabbi Irving Miller, chairman of the American Zionist Council. We now turn you over to the speaker's rostrum.
Ladies and gentlemen of the radio audience, at this critical juncture in the affairs of the Middle East, as well as in the affairs of the free world, the Zionist Organization of America, meeting at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in the city of New York, is proud to present to the American people for an important address on the Middle East, its honorary president, and one of the most distinguished spiritual leaders of America, Rabbi Abba Hillel Silver of the Temple at Cleveland, Ohio. Dr. Silver.
My dear friend, I'm happy to be here tonight and grateful for the many lovely things which you have said about me. I shall cherish them. I am proud to have been associated with the Zionist Organization of America for more than half a century. I recall that I attended my first Zionist convention as a lad of 11, an accredited delegate from the first junior society in the United States, the Dr. Herzl Zion Club. Through these many years, which witnessed such revolutionary upheavals in Jewish life, so much tragic destruction and desolation in two world wars, and so much of heroic and rewarding struggle for the establishment, recognition, upbuilding, and defense of the State of Israel, the Zionist Organization of America has stood always in the vanguard of leadership and service. It pioneered in political action. It mobilized world opinion. It took on the brunt of every attack. And tonight I am heartened by the thought that in the uncertain years which lie ahead, when so much work will yet have to be done to make the State of Israel strong and secure, the Zionist Organization of America will still stand in the forefront, alerted, devoted, and unswerving as ever. Your present distinguished leadership under my dear friend, Dr. Emanuel Newman, who has given a lifetime of outstanding service to our beloved cause, and his associates, is a welcome assurance, both of competence and of courage. I referred a moment ago to the Junior Zionist Club, which I joined more than 50 years ago, which was named after the immortal leader of our movement, Dr. Theodore Herzl. Dr. Herzl grew old and tired and died spent and exhausted at the age of 44 in the service of his people. And he was fond of quoting to his friends a remark which he heard from an old fisherman. "The most remarkable of all things is when a man never gives up." To you and to our fellow Jews all over the world, and to our brave brothers in Israel, I could at this time give no more appropriate and profound rallying word and slogan. The state of Israel was not founded by men who easily gave up. This requires no elaboration before an audience such as this, which knows the history of the tense battle days of our movement. The state of Israel was not defended in the War of Liberation 8 years ago and again in the War for Survival a short time ago by men who easily gave up. And you will agree with me that the state of Israel, which is so gravely beset today, will not be firmly established upon its foundations by faint-hearted men, but by those whose courage exceeds their fears, who know how to underwrite strong convictions by lifelong sacrificial loyalties. I am proud, my dear friends, of the way our people everywhere reacted to the ominous events of the past few weeks and months. As always, their resistance grew like a coiled spring in proportion to the pressure which was put upon it. Our people closed rank and demonstrated even greater resolution and solidarity and generosity. I was especially gratified by the political maturity which our people displayed, in that they refused to be taken in by all the synthetic international cant, by Sir Galahad riding the Arab steed in quest of the Holy Grail of oil, and by Ivan the Red, hot from the shambles of Hungary, shedding crocodile tears over aggression and colonialism. For the time being, at least, the state of Israel has passed from the zone of military danger to the zone of what might be called diplomatic danger. A small nation can lose more on the diplomatic checkerboard than it can win on the battlefield. It behooves us, therefore, to watch closely the maneuvers which are currently going on at home and abroad. We should turn again to our friends as we did in the past, and we have many of them in all parts of the world, in many of the delegations to the United Nations, and among free people everywhere, and keep them fully informed and solicit their continued help in safeguarding the life and the independence of this valorous little republic which they helped to establish and which, we believe, has faithfully justified their early hopes. Above all, we must keep Israel economically strong. Its enemies, unable to destroy it militarily, hope to undermine it economically by means of blockades and boycotts and by forcing it to support a costly military budget. Therefore, every new industry which is established in Israel, every new mine or mill or factory, every new ship or harbor or road or railway track, every new settlement or irrigation project is so much red blood poured into the life stream of the nation. I'm thinking, dear friends, this evening of the United Nations. There are those who believe that this world organization has come out stronger as a result of the role which it played in the recent Egyptian affair. Everyone wishes the United Nations to be strong and effective. But I'm of the opinion that the real testing of the United Nations is yet to come. And it will come soon in the Near East. And on its outcome will depend the very survival of that international organization which was called into being to preserve the peace of the world. The ceasefire which was achieved is an occasion, not necessarily the prelude to permanent peace. The United Nations force, now gathering in the Middle East, if intelligently employed, may prove to be an important step toward the final solution of those issues which have kept that part of the world in needless turmoil and tension for years. Or it may lead only to a restoration of the status quo ante from which all evils flowed, and for a carte blanche to the dictator Nasser to resume all his former and dangerous plottings and adventures. Nothing has so far happened as a result of the intervention of the United Nations to discourage Nasser from believing that the United Nations force will restore him to his former position and prestige, his commandos free to range again across the borders of Israel, his blockade against Israeli shipping in the Suez Canal and in the Gulf of Aqaba to remain in force, and he himself free to acquire again new stores of weapons and munitions for an attack upon Israel, now that the Israeli forces forestalled his contemplated attack so calamitously a few weeks ago. Our government has evidently concluded that the best hope for peace in the Middle East lies in the United Nations, and has resolved to channel through it all future considerations of the problems of that area. This is a procedure which it did not follow heretofore, choosing rather to find solutions outside the framework of the United Nations. It therefore becomes increasingly urgent that our government, whose authority and prestige in that area seems to have been augmented by recent events, should proceed to exercise forthright leadership in the United Nations in order to achieve the desired solution. Without such leadership, nothing constructive will come to pass, and the situation will rapidly deteriorate. Unless the United States and the other free nations of the world take strong initiative in the United Nations for a just settlement, it is quite possible that the Asian-African bloc, which has been uniformly hostile to Israel, coupled with the support of the Soviet bloc, which as part of its strategy to penetrate the Middle East can be counted upon to vote consistently against Israel, will succeed in imposing the kind of a settlement which Israel, as a matter of survival, would be forced. It is clearly to the best interest of the free world to make secure and viable the one dependable free democratic state in the Near East. The traditional position of our country as regards Israel has been expressed time and again by the leaders of our government and by both major political parties. It was recently restated in the platform of the Republican Party at its national convention. We regard the preservation of Israel as an important tenet of American foreign policy. We shall support the independence of Israel against armed aggression. Our government should not wait until there is armed aggression, and until that innocent victim of aggression, the little Hitler of the Nile, has had time to rebuild his badly shattered military establishment, or until Syria, bent upon Israel's disintegration, to use the recent phrase of the Syrian ambassador to the United States, has had time to accumulate a vast arsenal of tanks and planes and guns, which will be eagerly supplied to it by the Soviet Union. Playing for time in this area of the globe is playing with disaster. A new excuse for procrastination and a new formula for inaction is beginning to emerge. The Arab states want time to grow stronger militarily, to regroup and to reorganize, so that at the proper moment they will be able to confront Israel with ultimatums and dictate a peace settlement on their own terms. This is the meaning of the inspired talk one hears today, that this is not the time for direct negotiations between Israel and its Arab neighbors. Tempers are too hot. Perhaps in 2 years such a step might be undertaken. Dr. Fauzi, Egyptian foreign minister, speaking last Thursday before the National Press Club in Washington, was asked to answer the statement which was made to the press club by Israel's foreign minister, Golda Meir, in which he said that Israel was willing to negotiate peace with Egypt directly, immediately, and without any preconditions. He replied, "These things have their time in history." Dr. Fawzi Frevis said that Egypt was not willing to discuss the passage of Israel ships as part of a Suez Canal settlement. "This is part and parcel of the Israeli question," he said, "which we are willing to discuss at the proper time. It is not a proper part of the Suez question." But why not? The most right-thinking people, the blockade of the Suez Canal against Israeli shipping is the very proof, the very evidence of Egypt's illegal usurpation and of the insincerity of its pledge to keep the canal open to the shipping of the whole world. It glaringly reveals Egypt's intentions not to insulate the operation of the canal from national politics, but to close it whenever it chooses, whenever it serves its own political ends, regardless of international treaties and commitments. May one ask, when will be the proper time when Egypt will be pleased to discuss the passage of Israel's ships through the canal? And when will be the proper time for final peace negotiations? The 8 years which have elapsed since the armistice was fixed have not been sufficient to cool off the hot tempers in the Near East. On the contrary, the passage of time has served only to acerbate the situation to a point of explosion. Will another 2 years or 5 years or 10 years under identical armistice conditions help to cool off these tempers? How plausible, but how specious is this formula which is now being paddled about, a formula patently designed to cover up a maneuver for a complete return to the pre-invasion status in order to satisfy Nasser and his allies. The foreign minister of yet another Arab state, Iraq, is not satisfied even with return to this status. Nothing will satisfy him and his government but the complete obliteration of the state of Israel. Israel, he declared last week, should no longer be a state. It is simple as all that. And since Iraq is unable to accomplish this feat single-handed, or even in collaboration with its Arab neighbors, where collaboration appears to be so singularly difficult to attain, quite recently Iraq was loudly calling for help, not against Israel, but against Syria, her Arab neighbor, which with the aid of Russian arms and volunteers was threatening to attack her. Iraq now hopes that the United Nations will perform this little service of political assassination to please it and to achieve peace and unity in the Arab world. In this connection, it should be borne in mind that Iraq is a member of the Baghdad Pact group of nations, which our government called into existence, which it is now being urged again to join officially. Our government has been supplying arms to Iraq, and at this very moment, Iraq is soliciting a substantial increase in the volume of American military aid. It should also be recalled that American military aid was denied the State of Israel on the convenient but not consistently applied formula that our country does not wish to become involved in an arms race. And the State of Israel was also excluded from the regional security arrangements of this Baghdad Pact and was denied any other security treaty such as our country has with many other nations. It is now suggested that the United Nations should not exploit to the fullest its dramatic and energetic ingress into that long-disturbed area of the Middle East, but it should quickly withdraw and leave the fate of that part of the world to the will and the whim of these governments who have consistently proclaimed their unwillingness to make peace. In our judgment, the United States should press forward most energetically in the Council of the United Nations for immediate action, which will bring the representatives of the governments of the Near East together around a conference table for the urgent settlement of all the outstanding issues. And it has been Israel's contention, that there is not a single issue, whether it be territory or refugees or compensation, which cannot be settled with goodwill and a desire for peace. It is not enough to clear the Suez Canal so that oil may flow freely again to the Western world. It is all important for the peace of the world that the major obstacles which have for years impeded free communications, trade, and cooperation between the peoples of the Near East and fostered bitterness and acrimony and led to periodic and bloody outbreaks and successive crises, that these should be removed without delay. And here is the challenge to true statesmanship: to denounce your friends when they have been driven to acts of desperation, partly due to your own blunders, may give you a momentary feeling of self-righteousness as well as of expiation. To help them to achieve just and lasting political settlements in which you yourself assume full responsibility is the only true way to political wisdom, friendship, and leadership. Furthermore, you will never serve the best interest of the free world if your primary consideration is to compete for prestige in the Arab world and to appear as its special friend and defender. Governments which are bent upon intrigue play that sort of a game. Governments which are sincerely concerned with undergirding the threatened structure of the whole free world will help those nations, large or small, whose traditions are the traditions of freedom, whose way of life, whose hopes and ideals are bound up with the future of a free society. It should be remembered that even before the United Nations ordered a ceasefire and the withdrawal of Israeli forces from the Sinai Peninsula, the Prime Minister of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, let it be known that he was prepared to propose to his government the immediate withdrawal of all Israeli forces if Nasser would sign a clear undertaking to abstain from further hostile acts against Israel, including undertakings for liquidating the Fedayeen, abolishing the blockade in the Suez and the Gulf of Aqaba, and abstaining from military alliances directed against Israel. These conditions were not met then, and they have not yet been met. It would be a colossal blunder for the United Nations to have gone all this tremendous diplomatic activity in recent months and the dispensing of a police force to withdraw and leave the situation in the same perilous condition in which it was prior to October. It would be unwise to permit Egypt to return to the Gaza area from which she used to mount her Fedayeen raids on Israel. Gaza is not Egyptian territory. It would also be an act of great prudence to demilitarize all or part of the Sinai Peninsula so that it could serve as a welcome buffer between Egypt and Israel. My dear friend, Israel does not want war. Israel was provoked to attack as its only way of survival. It could not wait until Nasser's mountain of tanks and guns and bombers, part of which following his defeat the world was able to examine with amazement, until that mountain came crashing down upon it. For 8 years, Israel has appealed to the United Nations and the free world for help against constant harassment and menace, but nothing was done. No sanctions were invoked against Israel when it flouted the orders of the United Nations to end the blockade against Israeli shipping. Nothing was done to end the economic boycotts against Israel. Nothing was done to check the unprecedented flow of armaments to the Near East, all aimed at the destruction of Israel. Nothing was done to counteract the military alliances which were being forged like a ring of steel around Israel. What did the world expect Israel to do? Did the world expect Israel to sit there like a clay pigeon and helplessly and resignedly await destruction and extinction? Thank God Israel did not. And if I know the people of Israel, they never will at any time in the future. If you live in a neighborhood where your neighbors are determined to make your life miserable, they smash your windows, they tear up your garden, they beat up your children, you reason and argue with them to no avail. You appeal to the police, but they're unwilling or unable to protect you. You become aware of a concerted plan afoot on the part of your neighbors to tear your house down completely over your head. If then an opportunity presents itself, and you're able to lay hold of the biggest bully of the lot and the ringleader, and beat daylight out of him, so that he can no longer molest you, would any fair-minded man call this aggression? Israel does not want war. Israel does not want war. Many of the citizens of Israel are themselves refugees from war. They know what war is. They experienced all its horrors. Many of them left their sons and daughters and husbands and parents in the horror hills of Nazi, fascist, and communist wars in Europe. All that these people who have found a haven in Israel want is peace and a chance to work and build a new life. They want to create something fine for themselves, their country, and mankind. They covet nobody's territory, but they are resolved to defend their own. Their tradition, which is Judaism, hates war and the shedding of blood. There is no glorification of war in Judaism. There was never any call in Israel to become a great military power or to build a great empire. That Jews could fight when necessary and with extraordinary valor and heroism. The legions of Rome, the armies of Antiochus, the hosts which faced Joshua, and quite recently the routed and scattered divisions of Nasser could well testify. But Israel never emphasized its military achievements. Its hope for the future was bound up with the hope of universal disarmament, with an international society banded in brotherhood and united by the law of justice and unity and freedom. And the modern state of Israel is the heir of this noble tradition. It seeks peace and friendly cooperation with all its neighbors. It has sympathized with the national aspirations of all the Arab peoples. It has welcomed the inexorable march of colonial peoples to freedom and independence. It claims that same freedom for itself and that same national independence. Israel therefore hopes that the present providential moment will be seized by all nations of goodwill to bring about a condition of peace and stability in this region of continued violence. Israel fervently hopes that before very long, some real statesmen, some socially minded statesmen, deeply interested in the well-being of their people, will arise in the Arab world, who will see the picture as it is, not as the predatory eyes of politically immature demagogues see it. The severe social and economic problems of the exploited, impoverished, and illiterate Arab masses cannot be solved either by the obliteration of the State of Israel or by the...
You have been listening to an address by Dr. Abba Hillel Silver delivered at the dinner of the Zionist Organization of America in the Waldorf Astoria in New York. The Zionist Organization of America, sponsor of this broadcast, is dedicated to the strengthening of democracy in the Middle East and seeks to build America-Israel friendship. The views expressed were those of the speaker. This program came to you from New York. This is the ABC Radio Network.